This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're catching up on the latest news out of Washington following Kevin McCarthy's announcement that he is withdrawing from the race to succeed John Boehner as Speaker of the House.
McCarthy made the unexpected announcement yesterday afternoon, said that he didn't think he was the right person to unite the party.
I think there's something to be said for us to unite. We probably need a fresh face. I'll stay on as majority leader. But the one thing I found in talking to everybody, if we are going to unite and be strong, we need a new face to help do that.
Now Republicans are scrambling to find a new candidate, and many are asking Representative Paul Ryan from Wisconsin to step up to that plate.
We're joined now by Paul Singer, USA Today's Washington correspondent, who's been following this story. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Well, I'm good. So Kevin McCarthy says, hey, we need a new face. Not clear who that face is going to be. Where did that leave Republicans? We heard stories of tears in the cloakroom.
I mean, I think it was a tremendous shock. I will tell you that we were all anticipating that he would get the easily get the majority of the Republican conference to support his nomination, and that's all he needed to get to the House floor for a vote. Now, the problem was that getting to the House floor for a vote, he needed to get 218, which is more than a majority of the Republican caucus. They have 247 members, but there were 30 or 40 conservatives who were refusing to vote for him, refusing to support him. And basically, he was going to be in this position of having to negotiate for support, and it was unclear that he would be able to get it anyway. And then this question was how much he was going to give up, how much was he willing to give away. And it just became untenable for him.
Now, we don't know what was going on in Kevin McCarthy's mind at this point. How big a role was that Freedom Caucus and the idea that he's going to have these negotiations, maybe give up some of the power of the speaker to be the speaker?
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, he was in a bit of a box. The Freedom Caucus was demanding, essentially, as you said, that he give up some of, they rewrite the rules of the House, basically, or at least the rules of the Republican Caucus, to give the committee chairman more power, to have more conservatives at the chairman posts in the committees, to get more votes on conservative measures that might be embarrassing or difficult for other members of the Republican caucus, you know, stuff that the speaker tries to avoid and doesn't want to do. Which the other choice that McCarthy would have had was to say, well, to heck with you guys, I'll just try and get 20 votes from the Democrats. And that would have been a very interesting and delicate dance. So, it just made it untenable.
Having to get the votes from the Democrats is not a good way to kick off your term as Speaker and try to unify the Republican side of the House.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, this I will say this for this Freedom Caucus. I mean, this is the same reason that Mr. Boehner announced he was retiring. It was because they were going to call essentially a no-confidence vote. He thought he would easily win that vote, but again, it was going to be one of these things where they were going to have to scrap and arm twist and fight, and members would be forced to take difficult votes, and he didn't want to put them in that position.
Well, speaking of that Freedom Caucus, one member of the Wisconsin delegation, Reed Ribble, announced yesterday amidst all this that he's leaving the Freedom Caucus. He said he liked where they were on policy, didn't like where they were on leadership. Are they starting to get a bad name for themselves among a wider number of Republicans in Congress?
Yeah, Ribble is actually the second member of the caucus to quit in the past couple of weeks for basically the same reason, that they don't like the tactics. They are a little concerned that the Freedom Caucus is turning its guns on its own, basically. So now instead of attacking the Democrats and Obama, they are attacking, you know, the core of the Republican leadership, and they have left the party at the moment in swim mode. I mean, there's no way, no clear path forward, short of Paul Ryan, which is not yet a clear path forward.
Right. I mentioned Reed Ribble, but the Wisconsin congressman everybody's watching is Representative Paul Ryan. Here's Kevin McCarthy himself talking about Ryan.
Paul is looking at it, but it's his decision. If he decides to do it, he'd be an amazing speaker.
Now, Paul Ryan's been saying, nope, not going to do it, not going to do it. But we're hearing some insiders saying, yeah, he's thinking about it. So what are we watching for from Paul Ryan?
Well, at this point, the reports are that Ryan is going to go home for the weekend and talk it over with his family and try to figure out what to do. I mean, it's an interesting position he's in. There is, I think, no doubt that he would get the majority votes of the caucus. I think even a lot of the conservatives would support him, although some will still refuse to support him because he's too institutional. But he is sort of the white knight they are hoping for. The problem, of course, is that becoming the Speaker of the House and having to solve some of the institutional problems and to, you know, get the debt ceiling raised and possibly raise the spending caps that were agreed to a couple of years ago would alienate him with the Republican grassroots and crush any hope of a future political career in, like, oh, I don't know, running for the presidency. So it's a tough call for him, basically coming to the service of his party.
More coming up on Paul Ryan and the search for the next Speaker of the House. We've got Paul Singer with us from USA Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Paul Ryan, whether you like him or not, should he take the nod, be the Speaker of the House? What's in it for him? How it might it hurt him? What would you like to see come out of all of this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with USA Today correspondent Paul Singer right now about the search for the next Speaker of the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who should replace John Boehner? Not going to be Kevin McCarthy. A lot of people want it to be Paul Ryan. What do you think? 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller. Kenneth is on the line with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. You know, they were talking about getting someone from the outside. Was this their way? I mean, this was their chance to get rid of Donald Trump.
Kenneth, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Now, this is news to me, Paul. I didn't know this until today. You don't have to be a member of Congress to be the Speaker of the House legally. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The Constitution creates the position. So it is the one constitutional position in the Congress. You know, it's set up that way. And it just says that the House shall choose its Speaker. It doesn't say anything about how it's required. And so, no, you don't have to be a member of Congress, but every Speaker has been.
Trump may be unlikely. Newt Gingrich, I understand, has said, hey, I'd be willing to take the gig again if you guys want me to.
Yeah, I'm not banking on either one of those. But, you know, there was a point yesterday afternoon when people in the House were voting on, you know, various measures. And so they're all sort of wandering around out there. And we were chasing them all down the hall. And they were telling us, well, you know, like 10 people came up to me and they're saying, hey, I'm running. Can I have your vote? So it's been pretty wide open. Who knows who they might get?
We're all preparing our resumes over here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, actually. I'm going for George Clooney, I think. I want a good-looking Speaker.
All right. Yeah, that works. Well, another name that's thrown around for the next Speaker of the House is John Boehner. Maybe if they can't find somebody to replace him, he cancels that retirement for now. He's the caretaker guy until, I don't know what, the 2016 elections?
Yeah, there's a bunch of possibilities. The first is, remember, that he said he's leaving at the end of the month, and he scheduled a vote in the House for October 29th to vote for his replacement. He's canceled that vote for now because there's no real candidate from the Republican side. It is entirely possible that he sticks around a couple of weeks while this sorts out. It's possible he sticks around until the end of the year. I mean, who knows? It depends on how long they can get a deal to actually, continue this thing. I mean, part of the problem is that whoever is in that seat still has to figure out how to pass a debt ceiling measure at the beginning of November, pass a government spending bill in the middle of December to keep the government open. And it's just not clear that there's any path forward on any of that, no matter who the Speaker is, which is part of the reason why it's not a very appealing job.
Let's get into the pros and cons for somebody like Paul Ryan. Sometimes you see a politician, when somebody's trying to nominate him for higher office, there's that false modesty, that false humility when they say no, and then they say yes. I'm not in his brain, but I don't get the impression that this is some sort of false refusal. It doesn't seem like he wants this.
No, it doesn't sound like he does, and there's a bunch of good reasons for that. One is that he's got a couple of young kids, right? So he prefers to spend his time at home and with his family and not doing all of the ceremonial and fundraising responsibilities. The Speaker of the House has a lot of travel, a lot of responsibility. That's issue one. issue, too, when you look at what is on their plate for whoever is the next speaker, it's horrible. There are a bunch of bills that are sort of must-pass pieces of legislation, a pending government shutdown, a pending government default. The conservatives are still going to argue that they prefer a shutdown to a spending bill. It's going to be a fight no matter what you do. And then, of course, if you plan to run for office later, like for president or something like that, you will have made all these enemies because you're forcing through a bunch of bills that the grassroots conservatives say are bad. I don't see how you win.
And Ryan made his name as a policy guy, economic policy, and this is like you're a line manager at a fast food restaurant / circus ringmaster. Your policy time is limited.
Well, and particularly if you have to negotiate a deal with the conservatives to give up a lot of speakers' authority and give more power to basically a bunch of currently backbenchers, it would be essentially like the ringmaster telling the animals they can go ahead and rule themselves for a while. And that can't be any fun either.
And Paul, I'm not sure if you're aware, there's some kind of elections coming up next year. How does this whole thing where people are saying, oh, this is chaos among the Republicans in the House, how does this affect presidential race, if at all, races for Congress in 2016, if at all?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you can look at this in a couple different directions. One, it looks good for the Democrats and Obama and Hillary Clinton and the others because they can just point at the Republicans and say, look at the circus. Right? On the other hand, it is energizing Republicans. I mean, the grassroots Republican, conservative Republicans are very agitated, obviously, very energized over this whole thing. There was a, Fire Kevin McCarthy website even that got a lot of attention. I mean, you have Republicans more engaged and involved at the grassroots level in trying to control their party than you have had in a long time, and that might be a good thing. But on the other hand, it's a little hard to manage.
So, Paul, what are you watching for to figure out if and when we're going to have a new Speaker of the House?
Well, the first thing I'm watching for is for the clock to switch over to 5 p.m. Eastern time so I can have a beer and not worry about it for a couple of days. I mean, this has been a sort of a nonstop calamity for now, a couple of weeks, and we're getting kind of tired of it. I think the first question, obviously, the first major question is, does Paul Ryan decide to do this? And if Paul Ryan decides to do this, I think it cleans up a lot of questions for us about whether or not we'll have a speaker. The next problem is, how does Paul Ryan bring everybody to the table to get to the bills we need to get to? And that'll be a very interesting autumn. But I think at this point, the first question is, does Paul Ryan come back on Monday? And keep in mind, Congress is out for a week, so I don't know when this might happen. But at some point, Paul Ryan is going to have to actually nod his head yes or no before we do anything else.
Paul, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Rob. Have a good weekend.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He's the Washington correspondent for USA Today, looking at the quest for a new speaker. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's time now for Food Friday. As the weather gets colder, it's a great time to think about fall baking. And today, we're talking muffins. And you might be surprised, besides the sweet varieties that you might expect for breakfast, there's also a lot of great savory options, too.
Jean Anderson is our guide today to the world of muffins. She is an award-winning food writer, the author of several cookbooks, including Mad for Muffins, 70 amazing muffin recipes from savory to sweet. Jean, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, I think I know what a muffin is, but from that baking standpoint, what is it that makes a muffin a muffin?
Well, first of all, it is the easiest quick bread, meaning it's leavened with baking powder or soda, rather than yeast. And it's also the fastest, and it's the most versatile. And basically, it's, it's turned into a euphemism for cupcake because a lot of muffins are getting sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. And a friend of mine in New York said, well, at least we don't frost muffins. But we do sometimes sprinkle them, with a rich streusel or, nuts or something to, make them a little richer than they are. But basically, they're just very simple mixtures. You start with, you know, flour, baking powder, salt, a little bit of sugar, if you like. All of the dry ingredients go into one bowl. And then the wets would be milk, your shortening, which usually is cooking oil or melted butter, plus one, you know, large egg. You beat those up, and then you pour those into a well in the combined dry ingredients. And this is the key. Very, very carefully, slowly stir or fold the two together. Do not beat. Your batter should be lumpy. There should be flecks of flour in it.
Why don't you want to beat? What happens when you beat it?
It gets very tough. You do not want to develop the gluten in the flour, which is the protein. This is what you use when you make yeast breads. You develop the gluten, and that's what gives yeast breads that wonderful chewy texture.
And Gene, you blew me away with this right at the beginning. You basically solved every muffin error I've ever done in trying to bake. Every muffin thing I've done wrong is because I did not follow that. I over-mixed my batter.
Yeah, that will do it. That will ruin it. And what happens is that as you bake the muffin, you know, the developed gluten then stretches as steam, you know, is created within the muffin. And when you pull the muffin out of the oven, those muffins will be have alpine peaks on top. And when you cut into them or break them open, you will see that they do indeed have glutinous tunnels from the bottom to the top.
I want to touch on something you just mentioned in passing, that muffins have gotten sweeter. And it sounds like that's something that you're trying to remedy with your cookbook. You're trying to cut down, dial back the sugar. Are these muffins still tasty? What do you like about having a muffin that's a little less sweet?
Well, I mean, there's so many things that you can do with it, additions that you can add. I like some muffins, corn muffins, for example. I'll put crumbled bacon in.
Yum.
I often will put, you know, different types of toasted nuts, combinations of dried fruits. You know, we can now get dried blueberries, dried cranberries, prepared dates, you know, ready to use. When I was a little girl, you know, I had to open the dates, take the pits out, and then cut them into pieces, which, I mean, if you've ever tried to do that, you know that that's a nasty job. But, you know, I sometimes will, I've even made, for this book, I used green tomatoes. I made, you know, green tomato muffins. I make zucchini muffins, and I add curry powder. I make, you know, carrot muffins. And, you know, there are all kinds of things that you can do. I mean, they're natural for improv if you sort of remember the basic rules. And this is one of the things that I do teach in this book.
And we have a couple of recipes on our Central Time Facebook page. We talked to Gene Anderson, author of the book Mad for Muffins. And, Gene, one of the recipes you gave us that we've posted online, butternut pine nut muffins. Sounds very seasonal. Talk us through that one.
Well, yeah, butternut meaning, you know, butternut squash, not butternut nuts. But, I mean, what I do, I mean, really to shortcut the time, and this is another thing that I, you know, offer a lot of tips throughout, is I just use the frozen winter squash, which usually is either butternut squash or acorn squash. And, you know, just thaw it out. And then, you know, it's the same procedure. You know, it's flour. I do, in this case, use a little bit of light brown sugar because I do like the sort of more caramel, you know, flavor that that adds. And I also add a little bit of grated, I know you're the cheesesteak, and I'm sorry, but this is Parmigiano Reggiano. But you do, I think, make a good sort of Parmesan-type cheese in Wisconsin, don't you?
Oh, you can find Parmesan here, sure.
Yeah,
well, I mean, technically only comes from Italy, right?
Right. So, but Parmesan
the real stuff, yes. But anyway, I also add rosemary to this, which I think is, you know, a wonderful compliment, and toasted pine nuts, you know, which are U.S. nuts, and it's the same mixing procedure. What I do is use virgin olive oil in this rather than, you know, melted butter or, you know, vegetable oil.
What does the olive oil do?
Well, it just mellows the flavor, I think. I mean, I think I use olive oil for practically everything now. I mean, even toast. I mean, I just think olive oil has a wonderful flavor, and it certainly is more nutritious. So anyway, it's the same method of mixing, and, you know, plop them into muffin pans and bake them at 400, I think, for about 20, 25 minutes, and they're ready to serve.
Now, you mentioned Wisconsin being the cheese state, and we do have a cheese that we do produce in spades here in Wisconsin, cheddar cheese, and you sent us a recipe for cheddar cheese and cranberry muffins, which is mixing up the sweet and the savory, which sounds super yummy. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, I think this is a really good recipe. It's one that I got in another cheese state. You know, some years ago, I was writing a series of articles for Family Circle magazine called America's Great Grassroots Cooks. And one of the women I interviewed had this wonderful quick bread, you know, baked in a loaf pan that had cranberries and Vermont cheddar cheese. And I thought, gee, you know, that I really want to see if I could rework that recipe so I can bake it as muffins, because it would be much faster and I think equally good. So I did rework the recipe, and the liquid in this case is orange juice and lemon juice, and then also to sort of, intensify the flavor, I use orange zest and lemon zest. And, you know, again, it's the same technique. And bake them, I think it's 400 degrees, 20 to 25 minutes, and they're ready to go. And I think these would be great, you know, around Thanksgiving time.
Gene, you made a discovery after this book came out, and you sent us an addendum. Not all flours are created equal. Some brands of flour have changed in a way that makes the muffins not as good. So what's your advice on picking
up
flour?
You know, I don't know the state of flour in, you know, Wisconsin. I am not only on the East Coast, but I am down south. And we Southerners like very, very soft flours. And what happened not too long ago is that a couple of the major brands, you know, I think Martha White was one of them, and White Lily, were the two flours that Southerners swore by for, you know, biscuits, pie crust, things like that. And suddenly they noticed that the biscuits were tough and the pie crusts were tough. And some of the local newspaper editors around here started, you know, trying to find out what was going on. And apparently the company, which will remain nameless, that had bought these two brands had totally changed the formula. And, you know, it was no longer soft, you know, Southern flour. I was not using one of these flours. I was using a big brand all-purpose flour. And when I was testing the muffin recipes 2.5 years ago, you know, they were lovely and light and tender crumbed. And then when I, you know, went on, you know, started doing signings in bookstores, I would always bake several different types of muffins and take them for people to taste, and I noticed that these muffins seemed a little heavier, a little drier. I mean, they were perfectly edible, but they just were not the texture that they were when I had originally tested them. So I began researching, and I discovered that this big brand, all-purpose flour, had indeed changed the ratio of hard wheat flour versus soft wheat flour.
Okay, so that's something we should be watching as we make our muffins here. Not sure what brands are most prevalent up in Wisconsin, but certainly something to watch for. I do want to ask you before we let you go, with a cake, it can be hard to tell when you're at that perfect level of doneness. How can you tell with muffins? How do you know when they're done?
Well, the easiest way would simply be to stick a toothpick in them or a cake tester. And if it comes out clean, then it's done. But you can also tell the top should be, you know, nicely rounded. It should be nicely browned, not overly brown. And then just tap it with your index finger. And if it feels spongy, then it's done. And with muffins, really, it would be rare for any muffin to take more than 25 minutes. That is if your oven is accurate. A lot of ovens are not. And I know, you know, when I was a recipe tester in the test kitchens at the Ladies' Home Journal in New York, we had our test ovens tested every 2 weeks to be sure that they were spot on. And when we got reader complaints about recipes, invariably the reader's oven was way off. Most home ovens are 25 or 50 degrees off. Usually they run hot.
Well, Gene, lots of great advice there, and I think you've got us inspired to do some fall baking. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Gene Anderson, an award-winning food writer and the author of several cookbooks, including Mad for Muffins, 70 amazing muffin recipes from savory to sweet. Don't forget, we've got a couple of those recipes up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
I think I'm inspired. I usually do zucchini bread, pumpkin bread, that kind of thing. I want to try some muffins now.